of this commission. And I think we glossed over not only the local.
Right, no, but how that led. Can you give me enough of your background, just give me an idea how you happened to start at Lockheed and when that was?
Oh, well, the way it really started, I was a student at UCLA until such time as it got next to unbearable. I just couldn't carry out and try to live because I was doing it on my own. And my parents weren't here, they were in Texas. And of course, I had finished high school here. I lived at the Y, and through assistance programs, I was able to do this. And of course, I wanted a college education, but after I got into UCLA, I found I just couldn't carry the units and try to work and feed myself and, you know, all this kind of thing. So I got on the railroad until such times I figured I'd go back to school and I could complete my education. Well, it didn't work out that way. After I got on the railroad, I found it rather interesting, and getting a paycheck I found rewarding. So I decided to stay on the railroad for a while because it was adventuresome. I was going to different places, seeing different things, and all this was free. I had the benefits of a pass. So I accepted that, and I stayed there for 6 years, or close to 6 years.
When did you begin on the railroad?
I guess it was early part of 39 or something like that, and I stayed there until 42. And I came in as a cook, fourth cook, which is the dishwasher. I left there just beginning as a second cook. And the reason primarily that was because I was getting ready to get married. My wife didn't want a railroad man. I had to find a job. And of course, World War II came along. And I felt one of the best places would be to get into defense. Well, I made an application out, I think, through the Urban League. I'm not sure. I think it was the Urban League. And that was quite an experience because it's only, I guess, that was in 42, and they had never hired any blacks until the late part of 41, and they were screened and all this kind of thing, okay? I think it was 17 or something like that first brought in. The next group that went in was, of course, I was with that next group, which was the early part of 42, which was in March, and that was quite an experience because it was, what, took 2 days or 2.5 days just to take a simple, crazy examination to get into the plant. Well, I finally got into the plant, and after I got into the plant, the first thing I did was to try to find out if there was a union there, you know, because all of my people were longshoremen from my home is Houston, Texas, and all my people were longshoremen, and I had, union was a thing, you know, so I tried to find out if there was a union there. They told me there was, and I thought it strange. The steward never spoke to me about a union, you know, but I went to find out. And the vice president at that time was a young man, and he was rather progressive. His name was Sid Watts, and I will forget him. And I told him about it. He was the vice president of the district. And it happened we were working on the same plant. And I asked him about this, and he told me, he said, well, you know, there's a clause in our ritual that is supposed to prohibit blacks from being a part of the membership. And I said, what do you mean? Because I hadn't run up on this kind of thing. It was new to me. And I didn't really know all the mechanics of unions. I only knew that the longshoremen, because I was with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, it means that blacks can't join a union. I said, that makes sense to me, you know. He said, well, it doesn't make sense to me either. Herb says, but I tell you what. He says, I'll give you an application. And at the end of your probationary period, I'll submit the application and we see if we can't make a union. I said, beautiful. So he did this. And I guess soon after that, I decided I was going to go to a union meeting. Well, I did. And I was looked on as if I was, I must have been some strange from outer space, you know.
Did you go alone or did any of the other black co-workers go with you?
No, I was alone. And, well, I was prepared for it in a way because I knew the situation as it pertained to membership. I also knew the location, which was next to Burbank and Glendale and all that area, you know, which was anti-black all the way. But I felt that I was a member, I was paying my union dues, so I was going to go. I did go, as I said, I was looked on a bit stranger if I'd come out of space. Well, I managed to get through that experience. And nobody said anything to me, out of the way or anything like that. But it's an army, and I recall, I can't remember who it was, who said, look, we're glad to see you out, come out more, you know, I said, I would. And at that time, we had a vice, he was the vice president of that local, I think, or one of the other locals, and he heard about my coming to that meeting. He got in touch with me. He's now a trustee, a district trustee of the district, Clarence Gibson. And he heard about it, and he told me, look, a very liberal fellow, and he told me, he said, look, we want to see more of the minorities come out and let her get the others and bring them out. Well, I got around and started talking to the guys. I said, man, we don't do all that thing because they don't want you, why be a part of it, you know. And as time went on and the war gets, I mean, it intensified itself, mm-hmm. and more young blacks are going, and then they become a little bit more conscious of why it's so important to become a member of this, you know. And, of course, I felt it gave argument as a reason why. You know, I couldn't see myself being sent someplace to fight somebody and making things to kill them with and all this kind of stuff. And then they tell me that I can't enjoy the benefits. I could pay, but I couldn't enjoy the benefits of this union organization. So it just didn't make sense to me. And I never forget that some people came to me and said, look, these are whites. They said, look, we've been very anxious to get with the blacks to find out why we can't get something going, get a committee going to fight this thing. And I said, well, fine, you know. So they asked me at that time, because I was active in NAACP and the Urban League, and they asked me if I could get around with the fellows and if I couldn't talk with them. Well, I'd been doing this all along, and I guess they thought that maybe it was better that I do this, you know, to make a difference to me because I'd been doing it anyway. So we got together with a number of the blacks and a number of the whites, of course, too, and formed a committee.
Were there women also?
No.
All men at that point.
They were all men at this point. And but as our committee grew, there were women involved, both white and black. Okay? But when we first started, that was just all men. And I never forget the first little mass meeting we held. Was at a church on the east side across from the 28th Street YMCA. And at that meeting, my efforts to draw from the community, the ministers and those people who were active. At that time, as you mentioned earlier about Reverend Clayton Russell, mm-hmm. well, he had been really the spearhead on this kind of activity. And at that time, I was going to his church anyway because I was a youngster and that's where all the young girls, and because that's where I was. And he was a young man, too, very young fellow. And he understood the problems. So anyway, we invited him to a meeting, and the meeting turned out to be reasonably successful. There was a nice crowd of people there. And so we spelled out some of these things about being disallowed to be a part of the union and this kind of thing, and why blacks were hired into most menial jobs, because we were. You know, I hired in as a sandblast operator, which at that time was really a menial and really wasn't too well for health reasons, mm-hmm. too.
Was that true? Most of the black workers were in the menial job?
Mm-hmm.
And were they in certain departments and essentially segregated, or were they...
Oh, no. Well, you weren't segregated, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
You were in the departments, all right. But they were jobs as janitors and jobs as a sandblast operator, burrs, and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, of course... they developed a few, and they did have a training program, and they got into structures and this kind of thing, you know, assembly work. But that developed later.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, from this group of people...
The mass meeting, then, was designed to elicit support from the community for what you were going to try and do.
That's right. That was the whole idea. And from that group, the leadership of the black community, which was centrally located, for the most part, on the east side of town, and it was, I guess you call it, segregating away because it's mostly all blacks and Mexican and Orientals, you know, in located in that area. From that group, we were able to get ministers, we were able to get Leon Washington, who headed up the Sentinel, and who had been a fighter, you know, for this kind of activity in every area. Faye Allen at that time was the first black on the school board. She was a part of our effort. Gus Hawkins was a part of our effort. In fact, we made, these people made an advisory capacity to our little committee. And one of the reasons for that was, of course, I really didn't have the background of knowledge as to what kind of involvement you get into when you set up this kind of thing. I learned quickly. Well, it wasn't long before we were being potshot at and called communists and all these other kind of red baiting things. Well, in the group, there were people who were named communists. There were people who the FBI sought out and said were, and they admitted they were communists, mm-hmm. Okay? There were people who really tried to influence our thinking into other areas and issues. But thank goodness we had the kind of advisory people, as I said before, like Thomas Griffin, who is now George Griffin. We had Lorne Miller. We had, of course, we had Leon Walsh. These people, you mm-hmm. know, sound citizens. And nothing ever came into our meetings but what we were trying.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Only thing. We couldn't leave it off.
How many of you from the plants were involved, would you say, at that point in the early committee?
All of us were from the plant.
But, I mean,
all the people that outside of the plant were the ministers mm-hmm. and the people I named. Gus, of course, at that time was in assembly. Leon Washington had a newspaper. Miss Allen's on the school mm-hmm. board. And Lauren was an attorney, and he was attorney at that time. He headed up the legal committee of the NAACP.
What number would you say? How many of you were there at that point in the early formation of the committee?
Oh, the early formation of the committee, there might have been maybe 10 up to 20, because mm-hmm. We developed, first we got the group together, and there must have been about 10 of us. And it wasn't long before we had 20, you know. And, of course, from that we moved into this little mass you were telling about. We gave ourselves a name. The name was the Yea Vote Committee the Committee for a Yea Vote on this removal of the White Claws. And we called ourselves the Yea Vote Committee. Then we found out, of course, what had to be done to remove this color clause. That was the fight. And it was spelled out in the Constitution. Outside of convention, you would have to have a special referendum. And so many number of locals could vote on the issue in certain areas. You couldn't, everybody, say in a certain area could vote on it to be mandated to hold the United States. It couldn't be that way. It had to be in certain states and areas, of course, a certain percentage of people. Well, we thought about that, and of course the task was much too large for just us to do. That was in 42. And I think that the first convention that was held was in 45 after the war. You see, it was a long time before conventions, you see. And we were out to try to get this referendum. But that was, you know, the whole idea was. And I recognize there's no way we were going to get a referendum. But at least we could spotlight this thing nationally. And that's the thing mm-hmm. we wanted. And it certainly didn't want, and many of the people had asked that we take it into court. I was opposed to it, and our group the majority were opposed to it, because I always felt that you don't destroy something good to get into it. Because what I'm saying is that once you minimize its importance, then it's no longer worthwhile to be a part of it. And I always felt that it was better to get in and work from the inside out. You convert the people on the inside to change these conditions, you got the same thing. You see what I'm saying? Without diluting its importance or its power. Well, anyway, we rocked along with this, and before that, FBI came in. Oh, they did a job. I never will forget the first time they called me into the office. And they wanted to know, well, when they heard about this work that's being done, it wasn't long, about maybe a month or two. And they called me in because of what happened and made me the chairman. And they called me, and the FBI did, and they wanted to know why was I so interested in getting a union, and didn't I know that my activity was a borderline of communism and all this. And frankly, I didn't see anything communist about it, you know, and I told them that. And I also went into a story, which is a truth, how I came out here and the trouble I'd run into just being black, coming across the country, you know. And I'm relating all these things, this man, because I hoboed out here, okay. And I told him that they pick us up in Texas, just walking down the street and put us on a farm, on a pea farm, on a peonage. Had us working on a place on some big farm, you know, for a number of days. We had to pay for the ride out to this place, you know, by working on this place. And all this, I told him the whole story. He said, oh, no, there's no conditions like that. And it really made me boil on the inside, because at that time, I felt like that here we are giving our lives to something that there was unreachable. And this man's going to sit across the table and tell me what I experienced was a lie. And there was nothing I could do other than say, well, you're wrong. I went through it. I know it. Okay? Well, he went through this whole thing. He's trying to show me the point that interest, of course, was not of such importance and all this kind of stuff. I said, well, I know where you're going, but I tell you what, I just believe it is. And, you know, from my experiences, if there's anything I can do in the way of helping those people who are sacrificing their lives for, and they get back here for some rewards, at least there'll be a job for them, you know. And I says, and I think that is important to all of us back here. Well, anyway, he still talks about this thing. I guess we've talked about, oh, a good hour. And I didn't hear from them anymore until, I guess it was about a month or two after that, it was close to a year maybe. They began to name and lead an investigation of certain of the whites who were part of our committee. And they fired some. And
on what grounds?
They were communists. And they admitted. These people
they were fired as security cases then?
Well, at that time, yes. They said that they were a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so they were fired. And they asked me that, didn't I know that these people were communists and so on. I said, no, they never raised a question, because if they worked for Lockheed, they had a right to be in our committee. Now, you knew it, and you fired them. I'm not going to tell these people that came to be a part of my committee, because they're under suspect. Until they're moved, they're still eligible, you know. Well, they didn't do anything to me about that. In the meantime, though, I had talks with our international vice president, and he was a strong segregationist, and he at that time told me that it served the best interest of the organization and our own interest to have an auxiliary, and in I guess it was Oregon or Washington. And the Boeing set up that they had an auxiliary black thing, you know? I said, never. I said, I'll tell you what, before I will be an auxiliary, I will not join the union, you know? I said, I just don't believe in that. And, of course, we had a long talk, and I was trying to talk with him about how I felt. And, of course, he was telling me about how he felt. And in fact, I'll never forget it, because I had a long telephone conversation with him. And, of course, I knew I wasn't going to win him over, but at least I thought I would have had an exchange, mm-hmm. a conversation where he would have understood our position, but there was no understanding that position. Then, later on, they began to investigate me more. They were in my community, in the neighborhood, and were raising questions with people, you know, and they said, hey, what are you doing? I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm working every day, coming home and, you know, and working my yard and things like this. They said, well, we had people coming out asking questions about you. I said, well, you know, I can't help that. And, of course, they knew, too, that they were investigating me and all this kind of stuff. Well, it didn't really concern me too much, but it did my wife. It worried her quite a bit. And I could understand that because, first place, my wife didn't understand too much about this kind of activity. She's a minister's daughter, and she was not exposed to a lot of the outside activities like involvement and things that had to do with the social issues. And mm-hmm. She just wasn't. But what happened, I guess, that was all of 42, 43, and 44. And in the meantime, now my union is having me investigated. And
The local law?
The local, the district.
Uh-huh.
The district. The district is having me investigated. And I found this out through other means.
Hmm.
I suspect my international was too. Because I said I talked with the vice president of the international. And I would suspect that he had something to do with it as well. Well, it was in 1945. Now, in the meantime, we're still working with this little committee, trying to do things. We're keeping the issue alive. And as sometimes we have our meetings, all our meetings are public. We had them at the 20th Street YMCA. Or we found a church where we were having meetings, this kind of thing. And most of our meetings, we had some of our advisory people there, which was good. And I never forget, in 1945, the first convention was being held in New York City in the Hotel New Yorker. And it was, I guess, the first one since the 30s.
Okay.
Raised money by having social things, dances, this kind of thing, and to send a delegate to New York to a buttonhole. And so I was selected because I was the chairman or the president mm-hmm. of our group to go to New York and to buttonhole the delegates to see if we couldn't get this thing removed from the ritual. And that ritual read, see, you swore yourself in as a member of the International Association of Machinists, and you were not to solicit anything for our organization but a common and white candidate. This was to hold you in it as well as out of it. And, of course, it just boiled every time I heard that, you know. So, anyway, I went to New York, and I really had an experience there. I had my book with me, and it was Hotel New York, as I said. I went to General Secretary Treasurer, and I showed him my book. I asked him for a visitor's permit, and he told me that he was sorry, but the balcony area was full. And I knew he was lying. So I went out, went around, and went up in the balcony. And that balcony, I suspect, could have held 500 people or more. And I'm being liberal when I say this. Probably no more than 20 people up there. So I sat back so that I would not be observed from the floor, I thought. Somebody saw me up there, and they put me out. Well, I waited a while, and I went back, and they put me out again. So I said, well, I'm not going to make no big issue of it. I felt so bad about it, though. I had a lot of sympathizers. And if you did no more, was to arouse the interest of delegates, and particularly those in New York area.
Mm.
I had a number of those guys and in the East to come to me because I was on the outside all the time, in the lobby. And I made myself known. They could see me, and they'd talk with me, and they'd tell them what they were trying to do and this kind of thing. There was a resolution put in to take this thing out. They told me what they were trying to do and all. In the meantime, though, I knew the state or the city of New York had a fair employment practice ordinance, and they were the first to initiate this. And I first brought out a petition, and I said, well, no, I'm sorry I didn't, but at that time, I thought I was doing the right thing. Instead, I went to see A. Philip Randolph, because I had met with A. Philip Randolph in a number of times in the initial stages of the hiring of blacks into the industry,
mm.
because, you see, it was his threat to Roosevelt
right.
that unless you have an executive order and having the employment of blacks, that we're going to have a march. Okay? Well, the executive order came out, as you know. And, of course, A. Philip and Webster, who was at that time, I think, I'm not sure whether he was on the vice president, I think he was, of the Sea Gulf Warriors, and A. Philip, of course, who was the president, was placed on that commission. And they went around the country. And he had made a number of visits here to see me and the others, because we had already fouled ground and was doing things. And, of course, the first person I went to was A. Philip. And we sat down, we had a long talk, and he told me that efforts he could well understand, and he understood how I felt. It was a very good talk we had, understanding. It made me feel better, of course, but I was still feeling bad about it. And, I was interviewed by the press, the Pittsburgh Courier, which at that time was a leading black paper nationally, you know, and they ran a big front page and a whole thing, you know, about this outfit. And I next went to talk with Clarence Johnson. Clarence Johnson was a cook who was the general chairman of the Dinah Cooks and Waiters Union. And he left there because he was solicited by the government into one of the big jobs in government. I don't know whether he was in housing or not, but anyway, I recall, I know he was in one of the big jobs. So I went to see Clarence, and we had a long talk about this whole thing, and Clarence, I thought, gave me just a lot of good information, and he told me a lot of things. He told me about, how I'd have to pursue this and the whole bit, and I took it in. At that time now, the AFL, it wasn't the AFL-CIO then, the AFL had on its board, I think, one or two blacks. One of them, two I knew quite well, A. Philip and, of course, the other one. He was with the Diamond Club Cooks and Waiters Union, National Union. And I was asking if they couldn't do something about it. They were telling me, no, the position, of course, of the AFL was that the autonomy still rests within the internationals. And, of course, they could talk about these things, but as far as actually doing anything, it wasn't anything to do, really. So we, as I said, I talked to both of them, Clarence and A. Philip.
Was there any sort of equivalent group in the East, like the group that you had formed here?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. Well, what happened, I was stopping at the Harlem branch YMCA, and each evening, either some of the guys come over, each day I was there at the convention, because I was outside, of course, in the lobby buttonholing. But in the evenings, after everything was over, the guys would come and we'd meet and we'd talk about what happened and so on. It failed. It didn't go through. That was in 45. Then, if you recall, in the meantime, we're still doing a lot of work. I'm still working at Lockheed. Now, the interpretation was made by Harvey Brown, who at that time was the international president, when he swore blacks in. The interpretation was, that means the white of your inside. You know, that's the way they interpreted it. Of course, that was a way of avoiding, and I can understand that. And that got around having a field reunion, too. Well, after that back, we continued to fight. In the meantime, though, the union was still picking at those whites that they could identify as communists. I don't know a single black that they picked out who they named a communist.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that they tried, as far as I know, to identify me so closely with the communist people that they could do something to me. But there was no identification that I could see that would be substantial, which proved to be true. Well, we become a little bit interested in how blacks vote. So the union, my union, district, become Indians. But in the meantime, now I'm building friends in the Union, the whites as well. And I never forget, I got on the floor one night at a Union meeting, took up an issue as it related to blacks, and not knowing, because I was the only one there, and that meant many times that I was the only one. And I was surprised the number of people who felt the same, whites who felt the same as I did. They didn't initiate the discussion, but after I did it, they got up and were behind me 100%. Well, I began to take on strength, and the Union recognized that. So they decided they needed somebody that related to the black community. There was no way they could. And the AFL, County Federation, they too were interested. And it was decided that during the election years, the campaigns and stuff, they would get me released from the company. And I would be out in the field working for campaigns and issues, this kind of thing. And that went along for a long time. Well, up until I got a full-time job, but getting ahead of my story. I guess it was 1947, Tab Hartner came in.
Mm-hmm.
During that year, or just before that, about 47, we had an election for a delegate to the Western States Conference. That took in all of the Western States machinist groups to meet in Portland, Oregon. Well, I had already been elected a delegate to the California Conference and attended it, the first black to attend this conference, and all. It was something else. It was at the Biltmore. I'm not sure what the Biltmore. It was one of the downtown hotels. And I never will forget it. I felt so strange that the thing was, and that's why I really felt strange, because here you had people outside of the industry of aircraft.
Mm.
You had these what you call skill shops,
mm-hmm.
people and dyed-in-the-wool bigots, mm-hmm. and everything else, you know. And they just looked on me curious. I wasn't insulted or anything like that. I was tolerated. I could feel that. I can well remember things short of insulting me. They spoke to me in a manner that I thought insulting. Of course, you know, what y'all doing here? How y'all like this? You know, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through that, and it wasn't a bad experience of those things, because I felt like we had to find out that it didn't work around blacks, that they spoke like anybody else. So it was a learning experience, I guess, for them as well as for me, and how certain people act and react to certain situations. Well, at that conference, I didn't take much of a lead role in matters, because first base, I have to understand the ground rules. And I wanted to know how things went, what you did, and so on. And I was more really trying to get my feet wet and get properly oriented. Well, it's fine. Now here comes that July when we have the Western States Conference. I was elected. And I never forget, we raised money so I could go. Didn't impose that burden on, which was no burden, on my local. All the locals paid their delegates. And I told them, no, I don't do. We raised money, I can go, do it. Now, all up and down the coast, they knew about Herb Ward and that Yay Vote Committee. Well, I had my credentials, but now I got to go through the credential committee and submit them, and then it's got to be approved and all this. So when I get up there to do this, now mind you, all my delegates are there from my district, and many of them I thought were really solid behind me. I found out later they weren't quite so solid. Well, I'm standing outside the door to see whether or not I'm going to be seated, and you would have thought that you were in the depths of Mississippi to have heard the remarks about seeing me, a nigger, And I said to myself, you know, I'm standing outside the door. Of course, the door's closed. And there's a big, always a big argument. I never will forget it. And it really boiled me. I was never seated. They never really completed the argument. That next day, I went to see Tony Ballerini, and he was the president of the California Conference. And Tony is a good man, was a good man. He's since passed. And he said, Herb, are you a communist? I said, Tony, no, I'm not a communist. And I suspect I know as much about communism as you do, you know. He said, well, the word is that the communist paid for your trip here, and you've been this, you've been the other. I said, well, let me lend you some assurance. Everything that we got in the way of my fare, it was earned by the willingness of people to see that I got here by giving a party and this kind of thing. And he said, well, the thing is, I want you to know I'm on your side. He says, he gave me a long talk and all this kind of stuff. He says, now, I know that there can be some trouble behind this. He says, do everything to support you and your efforts. He said, but now, going to this conference may prove to be quite difficult. He says, now, it's up to you to make that decision. And I wouldn't tell you to go, you know. I said, well, I appreciate that, Tony. I said, but, you know, my instructions were from my people, from my little group, but the people from the union, my local. And I'm their representative. And he said, well, I want you to think about it. There was one fella there that I could have put a lot of trust in, that I know would still have fought for me. He wasn't there. He was in Vancouver on business doing something. And my delegation, a number of them, came to me and said, Herb, I would suggest you don't go. You know, they talked to me. And there could be a lot of trouble. We're going to do everything we possibly can, you see, because I come next year, the conventions take place, 47-48. And we're going to get that thing removed, you know. I said, well, no, that's fine. I said, but I just don't see why it's such a big thing. After all, my credentials are right. I was voted on, and I just think I should serve the people who sent me here, you know. Well, we had a long talk, and it ended up, of course, they out talked, and I said, well, okay, and they promised me every proceeding, you're going to get the minutes, you're going to get the whole bit, you know, and all that. They did that, all right. And so every day I was there, just like I was in New York. And, of course, if there's anything I missed, they had it for me. They didn't take an action on any resolution that would have served the cause of eliminating this clause for the next year's convention. They didn't do that. And that evening, the next day, I guess it was, the young fellow that I thought would have stood up for me, he said, what happened? And I told him about all the things. He said, oh, I'm sorry I wasn't there. You know. Well, anyway, he is now with the UAW. He's been with the UAW long, full time. Now he's been with them a long, long time. Well, anyway, that following year, 1948, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, they did remove the color clause. Now, it was 7 years after we had started this whole thing. I don't know to what importance was placed on our harassment played in that. I'm sure it must have had some, but I think beyond that, Taft Hartley came in the next year, if you recall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that had a lot to do with it. It certainly had a whole lot to do with it. I think it was a major cause. They did remove it. Well, after removing it, as I said, we still, the union still had doubts about me, of course, but they still had me out in the field doing things. Of course, I did. And I guess it was a few years after that, I decided to, they asked me to be a steward. And I consented to be a steward, and I represent my people in my department. I did that for, I guess, about 12 years. And they later asked me to run for business rep a long time before that. But I didn't think the time was right. And the other was that I didn't see myself running for any full-time job, because at that time the company was running a thing on identification of people by race. They had a code. Its only purpose, in my opinion, was to keep blacks from moving up into jobs. That was the only purpose. And he identified black male, black woman, Mexican, and Indian, and others, okay? And it was a long time before they moved blacks up into real responsible jobs. Long time. And I said, see, I would go to the floor and talk on this all the time, and I figured that as long as they had that thing there, I was free to speak out mm-hmm. without people believing that I'm just doing that to serve my own mm-hmm. purpose for being a lecturer job full time, you know. So I wouldn't run for anything that was full time at all. And of course, that went along for quite a while. And finally, the union took a strong position and got that taken out. In the meantime, though, I had run for the elected district job, which was a district trustee, which wasn't full-time at all, just once a week. And I did that for gathering knowledge, you know. Then I told them after they got that, I said, okay, I'm free to run. No, I'll run, you know. I did. I lost the first time out. The next time out, and one reason I lost is because I did take a position with John Snyder. At that time, John Snyder's name was like mud. They didn't want John Snyder, and of course, John figured as a way that he too could strengthen his ticket by having me on it. And I know that John was one of the biggest we had there at one time, but he had mellowed as he came along, and he understood things a little bit better and better and better. And of course, he knew me better, mm-hmm. and he understood me better as we had worked over the years. He saw my activity and so on. And we had a fine relationship. In fact, a good relationship. We still have. And anything I do to help, I want to do it. Well, I lost. He lost, too. Then the next time out, of course, I won as a business representative. I served as a business rep for one term, and the landlords asked if I would come on the staff. And there was a story behind that, too. They had been telling me that I was going on the staff for quite a while. And it happened. I had just been elected for another term. It was in April, I guess. No, it was in March. And I never will forget this. The landlords that time picked up two guys from my staff. And I said, well, gee, well, because I know why you're doing this, you're white. So I said, well, I know what's going to happen. I'm not going to stay here long, because I had so many opportunities to move away and get a job, mm-hmm. I mean a nice job. And I didn't, because I felt like this emperor served a better purpose. Well, about a week after that, I had a call from state apprenticeship consultant. And the fellow asked me for about it. I said, well, look, I don't want that. And I said, do you mind if I think about it? He said, no, I don't mind. I said, I have some other interests, but I think about it. He said, sure, it's okay. And in the meantime, though, Rudy Farpaw, was our foreign relations representative. And Rudy had asked me, it was just with the emergence of the black countries coming into mm-hmm. their own. He caught me in Washington there one and asked me, Herb, how would you like to go on the diplomatic course? I mean, labor attaché. Well, I didn't know what a labor attaché was, you know. And I said, well, I don't know, what is it? He was talking about it. He said, look, he says, we don't have too many blacks who would have the background of experience that you have. And we're going to need, because of the blacks coming into their own, we're going to need some black representatives. You may be a little bit older than what we want, but the fact we don't have them, you can get a job. And I asked him what the job paid. He told me, oh, that was a lot of money, you know. And they told me, of course, I'd have an assignment there. And when he told me what the job was, I knew Foreign Service officers lived in these various countries. This country, but they didn't know they were leaving that. And I knew that they made out very well, because usually their wives, if they're secretary material, teachers, and this kind of stuff, they can work. And of course, you live off their salary, but yours the bank, and you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, I told him no, I wasn't too sure about it. And he said, well, why don't you think about it? Well, I was going to be in Washington for a lot of reasons. We were there for some special meetings. That night, my wife was with me, and he made sure that he got with us. And he talked to my wife. And all this sold the program. But I still, you know, after we left, come back home, we thought about it because they were having a lot of trouble in Africa during that time, you know. And I said, well, why go over there and get in all that mess? I'll be exposed to it. Anything can happen. I think it's a nice offer, and I appreciate that. But I don't think that's the way I want to go right now. So I left them hanging. I said, look, give me time. They said, oh, yeah, you have time. I said all that to say this. When the Grand Lodge didn't pick me up, and I had these offers, I went into my vice president's office and told him, I think it's time I should be leaving. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I tell you, I have some offers. And one of them, he knew about the offer, mm-hmm. Diplomatic Corps. And I said that they're about to come to some fruition. And I have two. One's from State Apprenticeship. And you can call them if you want. I told them who to call. And I said, the other offer, of course, is from the State Department and Labor Department because it's going in as a labor attaché. Immediately got on the phone and called Washington, talked to Roy C. Miller. Roy told him, must have during the conversation, he must have told him, says, look, find out if the 15th is okay, he'll be on the staff, and so on. So when they finished talking, he said, well, what about the 15th? Come on, staff. I said, fine. And of course, from that time, of course, the guy I was talking was a wonderful guy, one of the greatest vice presidents I know he's ever had. Really a great guy. And I said, fine. He said, okay, Herb. Coming on our staff, and at that time, on his staff, I was to work between his office and Sacramento because my involvement in politics was such, you know. And so I did. I came on the staff and worked out of his office between his office.